Hi there, House Culture listener. If you enjoy this episode or have enjoyed listening to other episodes in our series, please support and donate to us through the Acast supporter feature. All donations will help us create the content that you love listening to. You can decide how much you give, and there is no regular commitment. So it could be a one-off, and every now and then, or once every time you listen, it's really up to you. Click on the supporter link in the episode description, and with Google or Apple Pay, it will take you less than 30 seconds to make your contribution.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hi, I'm Mark Knight, and you're listening to the House Culture Podcast.
House Culture.
Hello everybody, it's Matt Rouse here, the Managing Editor at House Culture, and I'd like to welcome you to another episode of the House Culture Podcast. As always, we're forever grateful to you for choosing to listen to our show today. Please keep spreading the word, telling your friends, loving, liking and sharing. This podcast is built from the support that you give us. Our last episode with Chris Lake was one of our biggest ever, and it's really boosted our followers. So, if you're one of those new ones, I'd like to welcome you to House Culture. We are a collective of house music fans who have come together through their mutual love of the beat to celebrate the spirit of house music. You can find our home over on Instagram at HouseCultureNet, so come on over and revel in the daily dance floor content alongside over 185,000 other party people. And if you haven't already, you can dip into our back catalogue of episodes that feature club culture conversations with UK house music originators such as Paul Oakenfold, Danny Rampling and Fatboy Slim, stars of the US scene such as David Morales, Danny Tenaglia and Roger Sanchez, or even those interesting behind the scenes characters such as Manumission founders Mike and Claire, Clockwork Orange ringmaster Danny Clockwork, or Pike's Hotel creative director Dawn Hindle. No matter their profile, we make sure all of our guests have an interesting tale to tell, so get stuck in, even if you don't recognise that name. As for this episode, I'm sure you're already well aware of our guest. He's the titan of the Tool Room brand, a DJ that delivers dangerous dance floor energy from behind the decks, and as you'll hear, a nice guy to boot as well. It's Mark Knight. In our chat, you'll hear how a young Mark started up his music collection.
I was always hell-bent on buying music. It was my complete passion. I'd get the bus into town, and in Mason there were 5 record shops, and I literally would spend all day Saturday going between each different shop just listening to music and buying music.
Why he decided to take the plunge and start up the Tool Room label.
I was releasing music on other labels, but then thought, you know what? Do a better job with myself. I really could spend hours and hours labouring over a record, hand it over to someone, and there just wasn't that same level of care and attention. I thought, you know, it makes more sense to do this myself and to up the process. And that's when the idea of Tool Records began.
And he breaks down the role that the DJ plays in a club environment.
That is the main job of a DJ, is to understand the context of what you're doing, what time you're playing, the amount of people you're playing to, the environment, and playing the right music under the banner of what you do for that moment. That is the absolute baseline of what we're about. It's getting that right.
There's plenty more to hear in this one, so get yourself tooled up, as this is Mark Knight.
House Culture.
Hi, Mark. Thanks so much for joining us on the House Culture podcast today. It's an absolute honour to have you on this show. You're an artist, producer, DJ, mentor and label head honcho that's had an incredible influence on the scene. Your tour room brand is synonymous with quality and is celebrating a very special anniversary this year. However, before we get into all of that, we always like to ask, whereabouts did you grow up? And how did you first discover music that you loved?
Wow, that's some intro. Thanks, Matt. right, okay, so let's go right back to the beginning. I grew up in Maidstone in Kent. Mm-hmm. When I grew up, it was in the 80s, and it was obviously pre-dance music and the explosion of DJing and all that. So DJing wasn't a thing. It wasn't a point of reference. It wasn't saying, I want to be that, because no one was a DJ. It wasn't an option. Mm-hmm. I always wanted to be a professional footballer. That was only one thing I was ever working towards. And I played at pretty high standard and semi-pro and did all of that, but knew I kind of wasn't good enough to get all the way or go all the way. But running parallel to that was this incredible passion for music. As I say, even before the notion of DJing being an option as a career path, I was always, always hell-bent on buying music. Mm-hmm. It was my complete passion. I'd play Saturday, go to football training Saturday morning, and then after that, I'd get the bus into town. And in Mason, there were 5 record shops. Mm-hmm. And I literally would spend all day Saturday going between each different shop just listening to music and buying music. If I had the money, if I'd accrued any money through the week for washing cars, paper rounds, all that sort of stuff. All of that went into purchasing records on Saturday. So it was always in me, I guess, mm-hmm. you know, for it to be an option of a career and something I was going to do later on in life.
Yeah.
Back then it was, you know, soul music, electro, hip hop, anything within the kind of spectrum of black music I was interested in, mm-hmm. anything. And searching it out, listening to Greg Edwards and Tony Blackburn and Robbie Vincent and Pete Tong back in, you know, early Pete Tong, yeah. back in the day when he was on Invicta Radio, you know, tuning in whenever I could in the evening on my tiny little radio in my bedroom, writing all these records down, and then it becoming my mission on the Saturday to go and then find them.
Yeah.
So that's, I guess, where the seed was really sown. And further to that, and I put a lot of thanks into this, I guess, really. There was a guy who used to put on a night on a Monday night in Maidstone for the kids. It was like a school disco. But it wasn't just a normal school disco. It was this guy, and this is his name was DJ Gary. Now, he could have played anything he liked, because, you know, school kids, he could play pop, he could play whatever's in the top 10, but he didn't. Mm-hmm. And he was hell bent on playing kids right hip hop, and I remember hearing, I've just remixed Nitro Deluxe. I remember hearing that.
No way.
At Kent Hall, it was called, on a Monday night. He was breaking records. He was playing records that he was passionate about to us, and it had such an impact. You know, it was brilliant. It was joining the dots for me. It was like, wow, these are the records I'm buying on Saturday. I'm now hearing him playing them. And it all kind of makes sense.
Yeah.
And really furthered my idea of music being an option as a career. Again, there was, this was still mid-80s. It was 84, 85, around that sort of time. So it really wasn't an option yet. House music hadn't been invented. So, but the seed had been sown, you know, and it was bubbling away. And that just continued all the alongside I was playing football. I then left school, went into construction, played football as well, did music and all of those things. So everything was kind of moving at the same time, as it were. And it then got to a point where our DJing was really beginning to kick off in the early 90s. And I had decks at home, and I was into house music, and I was getting the odd gig. And I was like, wow, I'm getting 50 quid a week to play football. I'm getting £200 on Saturday night. Wow, this is a serious thing. This could be an option.
Yeah.
And then started to play around with the idea of making music and and getting into that. And then it kind of naturally went into to a career. I mean, it started super, super organically. I mean, I remember my first ever gig was on a Tuesday night at a pub in Maidstone called Gabriel's. And it was the perfect learning ground, really, because, you know, you were playing to like 5 people. Mm-hmm. and you put one wrong record on, they're just going to go. Yeah. They're wrong. So you have to think about every single record. But it was the perfect way to really kind of learn my craft live, you know, and actually get a little bit of money as well.
Yeah.
Buy more records and the whole thing kind of perpetuates.
Well, yeah, I mean, like you say, like suddenly the economics of the situation between football and music, you know, if you're making four or five times the amount getting out there and DJing, suddenly why not?
Absolutely. And it took a long time before I took the plunge and went full time. You know, there is an economic decision to make, because at the end of the day, it is a business you're doing. You know, the fact that you're in music doesn't exclude it from it being a business. So it had to be done on a sound kind of financial model. And I'd got to the point where I was working and DJing. I said, hang on a minute, I've got two income sources here. Yes, it's going to be a big risk to remove one, but it's a passion. And I think I'm at a point where I've got enough traction and a little bit of momentum to take that leap of faith and go into music as a full-time option.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, and to make that leap, it's probably quite frightening or at the time, or was it something that was you're really enthusiastic about and just be like, I'm just going to go for it and I've always got something I can fall back on?
Well, at the time, we lived, myself and my girlfriend, we lived in Crystal Palace, and we were on our second house. We bought two houses already, and she wanted to go back to college and do a degree course, and I wanted to do music. So we sold the house, and we had quite a bit of profit in the house, so we used that to, you know, as again as a foundation for the next part of our lives. That paid for her to go to college. We both moved back to our parents' houses. I moved back to my mum and dad's, and then that's when Tool Room began, because Tool Room is a shed outside my mum and dad's house where we used to keep the tools. And then when I was growing up, I had a decks in there. We turned it into like a little studio. And we were four decks in there. I built this big DJ booth thing out of an old workbench. I kind of converted it into this kind of what looked like the main room of the ministry with four two mixers and all that. And we used to, you know, spend hours and hours in there. But ostensibly, it was the place where we used to keep the lawnmower and the tool. So it was called the tool room. And I moved back to my parents, and I was releasing music, and I was just about sustainable, because all the money that I'd spent on selling the house, I invested in studio gear, desk and computer and all the, you know, back then a lot of outboard gear. So I was releasing music on other labels, but then thought, you know what, I could do a better job for myself. I really could, because you spend hours and hours labouring over, or weeks labouring over a record, hand it over to someone, and there just wasn't that same level of care and attention. I thought, you know, it makes more sense to do this myself and to own the process. And that's when the idea of Tour Records began.
Yeah. You know, it's got such a kind of brand aura around it, in terms of, you know, the logo, all of the branding and the sound as well is very singular. You know, was that a very conscious decision for you to be like, we're going to go down this route and own it?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, a lot of work went into the planning of it. And I think that's key, really, is to know what you are. I think that's the biggest downfall for artists and labels in this industry, to understand what they stand for and who they are, and be proud of that and stand behind it, because that's where it generally goes wrong. People tend to chase trends, you know, to be relevant, as opposed to creating trends. And that's what we wanted to do. We wanted to own our own space, because that space came from our heart, and that's the only way to do music. And you have to appreciate that you're in it for the long run, and there'll be moments where maybe you're not as on trend as others, but that'll come back around again, and then you'll be at the front of the queue. So it's about understanding what you are all about, and then replicating that with the sound of what you do, and building a team or a roster around that supports that as a notion and as a musical identity. But we always understood what we stood for since day one, and that's never really changed, you know. I mean, so much so I can still play the records that we released in 2003 now in my set, and they would work because we've maintained that as a sound. And that's the biggest A&R compliment you can achieve, you know, that you have a sound. People send me records and they say, I've written a record, it sounds very Tool Room. Job done. You know, that's the ultimate A&R accolade, is that you have, your sound is synonymous to a certain thing, you know, in the same way as you put the radio on, you go, I heard a record on the radio, it sounds very Motown.
Yeah.
And even the layperson, they can understand that as an idea. And that's because it's a continuity in sound and quality and all those things that join a brand to a sound. And yeah. We always wanted to do that from the very get-go. You know, we looked at our peers at the time, the Subliminals, the Strictly Rhythms, and thought, look, we want to do that. You know, yeah. We looked at the branding of Subliminal and how far ahead of the time they were when yeah. they came out, and the consistency and quality of Strictly Rhythm. We thought, look, if we can amalgamate the best of both, then that should be the way we go. And we were just lucky at the time. I mean, my brother was a car salesman and he just lost his job, unfortunately. My dad had just retired. Mm-hmm. So the three of us sat down and we said, look, let's do something together. You know, it was sort of my brainchild to do this record label. Stuart was as passionate about music as I was. He was DJing as well. So we're both mad into house music, but he was not so much the creative aspect of it. He was more the business side, and my dad helping us with a kind of vision of what we were trying to achieve. So from very early on, we understood and we recognized it was about getting the right people doing the right thing. It's yeah. called the music business for a reason. It's not just called music. It's not just, oh, it's all creative. It's all just have fun, but make no money. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? It's the music business. And if we facilitate both aspects of what we're trying to achieve here with the right people doing the right thing, then we have a fighting chance of succeeding.
Yeah, yeah. And it's, you know, you said your brother's involved, your dad's involved, you know, it's very yeah. much a family affair. You know, it started yeah. in the back garden of your parents' house. You know, what are the drawbacks and benefits of working in that kind of environment with your family? Is it a safe, do you feel safe, that safety net, or is it just instant arguments?
It's a very polarized thing, really. Exactly that. You feel very safe. You know that everyone's got each other's backs because you're family. Yeah, on the other hand, most of the time you want to kill each other. So it's difficult. It has its challenges working with your family for obvious reasons, because you can be more vocal about your opinions, you know, and less tactful necessarily with your own family. So things are heightened, to say the least. But at the end of the day, you know that we've always got each other's back, so that it's underpinned by that notion. So yeah. It's brilliant. I mean, I couldn't wish for anything more, really, than to have a successful business with my family and come in and do something I love every day. I'm not entirely sure there's anything better in life than that.
No, it sounds great. And, you know, you were talking about the tour room sound as well, and that consistency. You know, people like to put things in boxes and genres, you know, is it tech house or whatever, all these types of things. You know, thinking outside of genres, how would you describe the tour room sound?
Well, I mean, we have a fairly large parameter in which we exist musically, you know. Mm-hmm. We can have our more commercial moments and we can have our more underground moments. Now, what ties all that together? Because they are different. They're completely different. And what pins it all together is the quality threshold, you know, in terms of its sonics, its arrangement, its production values, its amount of hooks. It's all of those things that create consistency and continuity. You know, we haven't got to do the same record over and over again, same thing. That runs out of steam, that's boring, you know. But you can tie all that together with one common denominator, and that's quality. And the fact that we've done that then affords us then to go on and do the Tour Room Academy, because mm-hmm. we have a quality threshold that's so high that we can then, you know, teach that. Most things that come through here, you know, I either get the stems and work on them, or, you know, Matt or George, we are very hands-on in terms of A&R, because we realise we've only got one chance to release a record, and if we can't wring the most out of its potential before we release it, we haven't done our job properly, you know, because we are a bona fide record company. We're not just a record label. Mm-hmm. There's a big difference. Mm-hmm. And sensibly, that comes from the fact that we have a lot of staff, you know. We have 25 people work here. It's a big operation. We really care about the product we put out. We care about the artists. We care about the brand and the sound and all of those things. And all of that is reflected in what goes into each release, and the passion and professionalism and knowledge that goes into everything we put out. So it's not just a case of receiving a demo and then uploading it. Far from it.
Yeah, and you talk about only getting that one chance to release a record.
Yeah.
How do you build the hype for a release? What's the best way of doing that? Is it you playing it out in like a promo sense and road testing it and tweaking it back in the studio, or do you like to get things nailed down like behind the scenes first and then launch it? How do you work in that sense?
A lot of records vary in terms of the approach. For example, we've got a new Casey Lights records coming that is brilliant. Mm-hmm. It's more radio focused, so you're not going to yield that kind of feedback you would do if you're playing it in a live set, because it's not for that instance. It's for daytime Radio 1, it's Dance Capital Arts, that kind of thing. So that's about really working on the record and its arrangement. Is the radio and it's super tight for radio, so that has an approach in its own right. You know, on the other hand, we're just about to release the Mojo record, Lady, myself and James have done. Mm-hmm. And that's a straight up club record, and that's about playing it as far in advance that makes sense to create hype and demand. What's this track ID, what's that, give it to a choice few DJs, get them to warm it up. Also, you get that honest feedback of what's working and what's not working in the record when you're playing it live. Mm-hmm. That's the great thing about DJing and record producing, that you've got the opportunity to road test things on a Saturday night, come back and tweak it and get it to a point of perfection or as good as you can get it before you then commit to release. So everything has its own individual approach, because it's not just a one-stop shop, because as I say, we have a parameter in which we exist, and we look at every record in individuality and approach that in the way which makes most sense for that record.
Yeah, yeah. And having that flexibility as well, like nowadays with modern technology, you know, you're able to just whack something on a USB and go out and play it that night, rather than have to, like back in the day, press it up on vinyl, you know, acetates and all that type of thing, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
In terms of that kind of technological change, and you know, that's kind of flipped a bit of the kind of crate digging as well. You know, you were talking in your youth, you'd be flicking through the records, like writing things down, that thrill of finding that release on vinyl compared to now, you know, it can be a bit more disposable, almost being able to flick through hundreds and thousands of tracks online. You know, where do you stand on that feeling between, you know, harking back to, you know, from that early period of your DJing collecting period to where music is now, and what's the difference for you?
There is a huge difference. As you say, you are much more emotionally connected to a product when you physically have to, you know, have to track it down, find it. There is that connection with that piece of music that has more depth than just being sent a promo. There really is. And even when it goes down to the artwork and the credits, I mean, I used to love getting the train to London on Saturdays and going record shopping, then coming home and spending the whole journey back looking at the credits and reading thing, and then building up this understanding of what happens behind the scenes in making a record, and then joining the dots between the record that you bought. Okay, it's the same engineer on this record, same producer on this. Okay, right. Okay, that's why I like that and I like that. Mm-hmm. And you start to understand the concept of what goes into making a record and who's behind the scenes and how it comes to fruition. So I guess you're way more emotionally, you know, invested in that than you are than being sent an MP3. Yeah. That said, that doesn't mean to say you don't get sent some great records, but I think everything that goes around that process back in the day, even the fact that on a Friday, we, you know, move fast forward a few years, we'd all be in the West End in D'Arblay Street, whether we're in Uptown Records or Black Market. There was a community of people that went there.
Yeah.
And there was something special about that community, the people you met week in, week out up there doing the same thing, you know, and that's obviously gone now because it's a more anonymous type situation where people at home just trawling through download sites. Yeah. You know, you don't have that connectivity, which was integral to the growth of the scene. You know, it was about community, it was about all of those things, and a lot of that is lost. And I genuinely think, and you know, this is quite a big statement, but some of the newer producers lack that community spirit that we all had back in the day, where we'd help each other out, go to each other's parties to create things. Everyone's kind of in it for their own gain, and house music was never about that. Mm. You know, pair it back and listen to some of the lyrics of some of the other records. It was about unity, collectiveness, all of those words, which seems to be less about now. You know, it's about I and me, I'm going to do this, you know. And I think all of the process that went into to record buying was part of that original ethos. And it's a shame that some of that, a lot of that's been lost, you know, because that's what underpins the movement of electronic music.
Yeah. And, you know, a lot of it is shifted to kind of online a bit as well. And having that being anonymous online as well, it gives people the ability to maybe say things that they wouldn't say to someone's face or all of those things and be a bit more negative about the way things are. Thinking about a real kind of DJ life lesson you're kind of dishing out there, you know, obviously you mentioned the Tool Room Academy as well. How are you involved with that, and how do you go about like nurturing talent that are coming through that? You've described it like a football academy. Is that how you see it?
100%, yeah. I mean, you know, I know that system well, obviously having come through it. And my son's currently in it at the moment at Crystal Palace. So it's something that, and in fact, I actually built a football academy as well. I have a football academy, which I run as well. But it is based on that model. You know, it's about, look, let's be honest, you know, not only the 1% of the 1% will make it through, but there is a channel from demo submission to growing and understanding the approach we have to making music, right the way through to playing the first team and being released on Tool Room. That there is a process that you can jump on, and if you're good enough and you shout hard enough and you work hard enough, that you'll get all the way through. And that's what we've tried to create. Look, the reality is not everyone will make it. I'll be like, oh yeah, everyone will. You won't. You just won't, you know. But if you're good enough, we've created a process that allows you to work through and fully understand what we're looking for, the level of quality, and you're being taught by some of the best people in the world. I mean, it's a bit like going to a football training on Saturday and go, right, we're doing finishing today, and today's lesson's been taught to you by Pelé. You know what I mean? It's a bit like that. I mean, God, I wish I would have had that opportunity when I was a kid, you know, for someone to teach me of that level. You just have to fumble around and work it out yourself.
Yeah.
But now you're getting taught by Dean Ramirez or BK or people like that that have been at the absolute top of their game, that have toured the world, you know, been recognised as, you know, some of the best DJ producers in the world, who are then teaching you all that inside tack and information. You're getting all that firsthand, along with the kind of curriculum that's based around what we do, the sound of Tool Room, you know, how we go about making records, what we're looking for. So it's an incredible opportunity to further your musical growth. And I think it's a win for all, you know. It's a win for us because we get to find some brilliant new talent that comes through. And believe you me, we have done, you know, from Maxine to people like Wheats to Cruci now. People, these guys have all been part of that journey, you know. We've found through that process and are bona fide first team players for us now that we're, you know, for example, Cruci, I think he's going to be an absolute superstar. I genuinely believe that. And look at people like Weeks turned up, but he gave us a demo at Brighton BMC years ago, and he's gone, you know, he's smashing it now, albeit in a slightly different sound now.
Yeah.
But, you know, that was his entry into the scene. And yeah, I think it's a win for all. We get to find talent, people get to learn. It's a kind of a no-brainer, really, for everyone. So we just thought it was the perfect opportunity. And I think after 15 years existing as a business, where we were at the time when we launched the academy and we really established the sound of Tool Room, it really, you know, we had legitimacy to say that this is a real thing and I think it's going to work for everyone. And it's it works really, really well. And all credit to Pete and Miles and my brother Stu. It's more their brainchild and they're the day-to-day. Obviously, I'm involved with how we grow it as a business, but from a day-to-day perspective, they're very much hands-on. I just kind of get to see the best of the best that come through, and then, you know, see if they get selected to play in the first team on a Saturday afternoon.
You're the gaffer at the top.
But I'm head of football, so yeah, you know, that's my role in it. But it's great because we do get to cream off some incredible talent. But there's also opportunities for people to release. We do compilations called Leaders of the New School, which is all the new talent that we put out on a kind of quarterly basis that gives talent the opportunity to release via the label. And we just, and again, we get to monitor and assess that, see the feedback of that, see if they've got real traction, how much energy they put into backing themselves, because that's a big deal as well, you know. Have you got all the components to make it as an artist? And that gives us an opportunity to look at people to say, how much energy are you going to put into your own release? How much are you going to back yourself?
Yeah.
Because that's, at the end of the day, it's exactly that. It's backing yourself as your own business, because it is a business, you know?
Yeah.
It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter if you're starting a restaurant or starting to become a DJ. You've got to apply the same kind of the business principles that apply to anything you do. So it's a great way for us to, you know, get an insight into what artists do and the way they behave, and have they got the right attributes to kind of push on and be a, you know, do it full time.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, Tool Room is celebrating its 20th anniversary this year.
It is.
Yeah. So when you look at what you've, before we start talking about the future, when you look at like what you've achieved in the past, are you thrilled that you've got this far? Is it a surprise? Did you think it would become what it's become? Have all of these different outlets? And also, what are you most proud of in terms of release-wise? Is it your own stuff or is it nurturing new talent? You know, where's your point of pride when you look back on what you've achieved so far?
You know what? I don't really get that much time to kind of objectively assess what we've done, because it's always about tomorrow, not really about yesterday.
Yeah.
I think with birthdays, you've got to be a little bit careful that they mean a bit more to you than they do to the general public. You know what I mean? And we don't want to get too lost in that as a notion. So we've kind of spun the birthday this year into a campaign called Music Matters. Mm-hmm. So instead of saying, oh, we're 20, look what we've done. Great. Yeah, but that's all well and good, you know. But it's all, as I say, it's usually always about tomorrow. So we've used the anniversary to kind of reaffirm, you know, one of the big beliefs that we have, and it is that music matters. That's where we start. We didn't start for any other reason. We started before the explosion of the internet and all of that. So it was about music and music only. And I think a lot of that has got sadly lost in the circus that is, you know, now dance music. So we wanted to kind of go, well, instead of shouting about how good we are, let's talk about the core message of what it should be about. So that's what we're doing for the birthday, for the anniversary, doing a big campaign called Music Matters. Yeah, I think it's a good strap line for us as well. If nothing more comes out of it, it's just reaffirms what we're about. We're not about anything else. We're about music. We are a music brand. What am I most proud of? I don't really know. I guess everything. I think everything collectively. What I'm probably most proud about, what we're going to do tomorrow than what we've done before. Do you know what I mean? Because tomorrow is the next challenge.
Yeah.
You know, we've done yesterday. So there's been some incredible marks along the way. We've released some brilliant, brilliant music. You know, I think off the top of my head, I guess Brixton was quite a big deal for us when we did that, when we sold out Brixton Academy. It was at a point in time where we were, you know, music nights were moving out of clubs, taking the leap of faith to move out of the kind of safe environment of clubs and moving to hard ticket venues.
Yeah.
And I think the Swedish House Mafia were the only act that had done it before us. Then we did it. So it was, it kind of reaffirmed the scale of the brand. That was a big marker for us. And, you know, literally to be in our own backyard was a nice thing. I mean, so many great records. It's hard to define, obviously. Film and Needs, in terms of its commercial success, charting really well. Mm-hmm. Then through to things like Downpipe, which is on the wall here. I don't know if you can see that. Which was another great release. Working with Underworld was an incredible process, which led on to myself and Dean actually producing most of their album. And that was a really interesting part of the journey of the brand.
Yeah.
It's been so many great things, but I'm all about tomorrow and less about yesterday.
Well, we could talk about tomorrow. As I said, this one's our August release. So we could talk about what you've got coming up beyond that. So what are you excited about doing in this anniversary year beyond August?
Beyond August. Well, in August, we've got some great shows coming up in August. Off the top of my head, we are in New York on the 5th of August at Musica. Mm-hmm. And then we're doing a big outdoor show in Toronto on Saturday, on Sunday the 6th. That should be a lot of fun. We've got a big show coming up in London. We're doing our first show in London this year. We're going to be at Village Underground. That is on the 19th of August. Mm-hmm. Crikey. Apart from then on, I begin to forget my dates, but got some great music coming up throughout the summer. We'll be releasing the Lady record. What else we got coming out? Oh, we've got a brilliant new thing from Salado dropping in August. Really looking forward to that. We've also got a release from Vintage Culture coming up in August. A record from Groove Armada. So some big names on the label in August. Past that, off the top of my head, I can't really remember. Just some really good things. The best thing to do is stay close to our socials, you know, because mm-hmm. there's so much going on. There's so many plates spinning here. It's hard to remember, you know, it's enough trying to balance it from a day-to-day perspective.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's going to be a really exciting year, a year we're proud of, to get to 20, that we always plan to be where we are. You know, it wasn't a surprise. It's not a fluke. It was always a long-term strategy that we had. And, you know, we're happy that we are in the place that we wanted to be, but we're still not at the place we'd like to be. We're still growing. We still have aspirations. We still have plans, some really exciting things. I wish I could tell you about now. I can't tell you about
yet.
But I guess the best thing is to follow our socials to see what we're up to. But there's always something bubbling away here.
Exciting time.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
And we've talked about Tool Room. Obviously, I want to talk about you as the DJ, you know, as the someone who is the master of their environment, you know, controlling what people do on that dance floor and, you know, how you kind of approach your sets as a DJ, you know. What when you're coming into a gig or an event or a festival, you know, what's going through your mind in how you're going to like deliver? Do you like to get there a bit early and see what's going on? Or do you just like to just come in and be like, right, I'm just going to smash this? Or, you know, how do you kind of operate in that environment?
I guess because I've been doing it for so long now, you kind of understand the context of where you're about to perform. Mm-hmm. And that's the most important thing. That is the main job of a DJ, is to understand the context of what you're doing, mm-hmm. what time you're playing, the amount of people you're playing to, the environment, and playing the right music under the banner of what you do for that moment. Mm-hmm. You know, that is the absolute baseline of what we're about. It's getting that right, you know, and that varies based on what you're doing. For example, I played in Brighton at BMC. Mm-hmm. We did the i360 pod, and that was to a lot of industry people at 9 o'clock. So I just played disco because that's the right thing to do mm-hmm. to that environment, in that scale, to those people. You know, they don't want to hear a banging tech house set. Would be the completely wrong approach.
Yeah.
But then on Saturday night, I was in San Diego, had to a room of 2,500 people that wanted it tough and played more almost like techno. Mm-hmm. So it's about understanding the environment and the time you're playing and playing accordingly. And that ultimately is what DJing's about. Look, DJing technically now is not difficult. I'd be a liar to say it is. With all the technology we have, it is not difficult. That is not hard. You can do it with your eyes. You don't, you know, you don't have to be as a, you know, as adept as you were when we played vinyl. That was a real fucking art.
Yeah.
Because it was just difficult. It was analog. It was tricky. And unfortunately, in some ways, it took your eye off the ball of what you were trying to do as a bigger picture.
Yeah.
Now you less have to worry about the mix because that's pretty straightforward. It's more about the vision of what you're trying to create long term within the size of your set, you know, the length of your set. Mm-hmm. You can think more long term. You think, right, well, where I'm going to be in five records. When you're playing vinyl, like, fuck me, I've got to spend 2.5 minutes getting this thing in time because it's so difficult. And then get through there, go, right, next one, what are we going to play now? Do you know what I mean? So you have less capacity to think about the bigger picture. Where now you don't. You're all about that. And that really is what DJing's about. So I guess through the knowledge that I've accrued over the years and years and years, and it is the only way to learn. It's the best way to learn is in situ, to know what works and what doesn't work. And, you know, thankfully I had that under my belt and that I can then apply to wherever I'm going to be, you know. And I guess with me, my sets are defined really by a lot of, I'd say 60% of my own productions, because ultimately that's what I wanted to achieve is it to be the full experience, things I make to then go and play. I didn't want, you know, there's no point in making a record if you can't play it, really. You know, look, I make records for different points in time. I have records that I make for 8 o'clock at night and then 8 o'clock in the morning. Mm-hmm. So I like to make records that fulfill all of that, because I love to play long sets. That's what I'm all about, open and close. That's my thing.
Yeah.
Because that gives me the chance to really express myself musically. You know, it's, I dare say, it's a bit easy rocking up and just playing 2 hours.
Yeah.
That's just, you know, look, I love doing it. And you come and you have to deliver, because people have paid good money to see you rock up and smash it. But it does narrow the potential of what you can do, because mm-hmm. you don't have the parameter to kind of get too creative, because people don't want that in a short set. They want you to deliver the things that you want to do. It's like going to see you too, and then not playing with or without you. You just go, oh, it's a load of demos we're going to play. Well, we don't want to hear demos. We want to hear the fucking hits. Do you know? You're only playing 2 hours. Give me the fucking hits. So it does dictate certain parameters. Mm. But when you play all night, you can go all over the show, and it really gives you the opportunity to express yourself as an artist. And I come away from those instances far more kind of inspired and fulfilled musically than I do than a 2-hour set. But that is the only way to learn, is through doing that, is through playing live to understand what works, what doesn't work. And that is the art of DJing.
Yeah.
The art of DJing isn't putting time in two records together. It's about, how do I build a soundscape or an environment over a period of time that totally makes sense and is flawless. Mm-hmm. That there's no bumps in the road. There's no jerks. There's no, oh, because there's nothing worse. You know, your name can tell you when you're going to a party and someone, a DJ puts a record, oh, he played that record and everyone sat down. There's no difference that, you know, if you're playing, you know, the biggest, you're playing at Fabric. If you get it wrong, you'll jar the flow. And it's all about having, in my eyes, the perfect flow of music that moves between styles and energies, but totally makes sense. And the only way to build up that ability is through doing it live. So, you know, you've got to get there and just know what works. But I haven't done it for 25 years. I've got a relatively good understanding of how to make that flow now.
Yeah, it's an interesting point you make, the real difference between whether it's like an episode of something or like the long form, like bingeable series. You know, are you going to come in for 2 hours? Are you going to come in for 4, 5, 6 and be able to tell a much broader story? Yeah, like you say, it must be more enthusing and inspiring that way.
Totally. I mean, for example, on Saturday I played, Friday I was in San Francisco and I played from open to close. And it did. We started at 118 BPM and it was just disco, and then went into, you know, some deeper house stuff, and then slowly moved all the way through the energies, and then just kind of ended up and into something more anthemic and fun at the end. Mm-hmm. And that was brilliant. I loved it. I come away buzzing. I got to play all a load of stuff that I love playing that really replicates me as an artist. And there's a window into my kind of soul. And then Saturday I played in San Diego, and it was a big room. I played for an hour and a half. I mean, you have to just smash the arse out of it.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's understanding the context to where you are and applying the right music for the right context.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And, you know, we'll come on to a bit in a bit about the tracks you've submitted for the Perfect Playlist. But I do have to pick one that that's in that list, which is obviously your cover version of Laurent Garnier's Man with the Red Face. And I think in your email to me, you said you'd literally get shot if you don't. By the audience, if you don't play this tune, you know, for you, that track in particular, is there a pressure on yourself? You know, you say you've gone to see them play with or without you. Is this your with or without you tune?
It 100% is, you know, and I generally play it as my last record because it's how you want to sign off. You know, you want to sign off with people humming it on the way home, and that being the thing you work towards. You know, I could play it in the middle of my set, but it's about knowing how to program it. I mean, it's 15 years old now. So, it's sonically as well. It doesn't sit as well as if you put it in the middle of your set, there's a difference in sonics and then it kind of sort of underplays the anthemicness of what it is. So it's about programming. And I usually play it the last record of my set and leave people with that as a parting gesture.
Yeah. And, you know, when you were putting that together, you know, 15 years ago, how did that kind of come about? Was it a track that you'd always loved? Was it something you're just messing around with in a studio? Was it for the Winter Music Conference?
It was for that when everyone used to write, you know, and it's a shame that people don't put any emphasis on that anymore because that was what it was about. You know, I've been going there since the end of the 90s, and it was literally about writing records, giving them to the right people physically pre the summer to kind of be that it was the precursor to what was going to be big that summer. You know, all the big A&Rs were out there scrapping over music. It was an opportunity to play things for the first time, road test them, and as I say, it was the precursor to all the big summer hits. So, you know, in 2008 I was still conscientious of that's what Winter Music Conference should be about. He's doing something for that, and always loved Laurent's version of it, but it just didn't make sense as a club record. It was a bit avant-garde, it was a bit too creative, dare I say, but it was about recognizing the best parts of it and formulating that into something that would really translate as a club record, because the kind of backbone of the melodic structure was there. It just needed to be formulated into something that was more palatable. And we were left it. I wrote a couple of things, but this was something what I did as a sort of plan B. There was another record I wrote as well as, which was called Shogun, which obviously we did good things as well as, but I just wanted something a bit more fun to play. And we literally started it the night before we went. And I was remember working on it on the plane on the way over there, finishing it off. And then dropped it at the Beatport party and the rest was history.
No way. So suddenly you realised, hang on a sec, I've got something here.
Hang on a minute. Yeah, well, and that there was the way, you know, whenever you try and write a hit, that'll happen. You know, when you just do something because you're passionate about it, that's when it's more likely to happen. So, yeah, it was one of those situations where, we just did it as a bit of fun initially and it just grew into the monster that's still played 15 years later.
Yeah, it's crazy. And, you know, what was Laurent's reaction when you caught up with him and he heard it and, you know, how did that go down?
He was really cool. I was like, look, mate, I've done this. And I sent him a couple of videos, but I think this has gone bananas. And the amount of people I had contacted me, can I have a copy? And he was like, yeah, I love it. Let's just do it. So, he was super cool about it. Yeah, I think he recognised it, you know, and he still plays it and stuff. So I think there's no better validation or authentication than him getting behind it. So it was a fairly straightforward process in that respect.
Absolutely. And you know, we've been talking about tracks. So let's move on to the bit where we're talking about our perfect playlist on Spotify. So this is the House Culture Perfect Playlist. So we've done over 50 episodes of this show. Every single DJ has submitted 5 tracks based on these different themes to the playlist. It's, you know, so I think it's about over 30 hours long now, which is huge. Right. And there's, you know, because of the themes that we've got, there's stuff that's all over the show in terms of whether it's dance music or left field or, you know, some anthems and things like that. So there's some really interesting stuff in there. So your submissions, we always start off with a catalyst, a track that opened your ears to electronic music, and you have chosen not one track, you've chosen an entire album which is 10 Cities foundation album. Just talk to me about the first time you bought that home, or maybe heard a track of it on the radio. You know, how did you discover that album?
I guess with a single, That's the Way Love Is. Mm-hmm. At the time, I didn't really get house music. At first, it felt a little bit straight, dare I say, a little bit white for me. It didn't have enough soul. Mm-hmm. It seemed a little bit simplistic. And then I heard that. I was like, oh, shit, yeah, this makes sense now. I get it.
Yeah.
I get the connection to where I was before musically. Around that time, I was really into swing beat, like Teddy Riley and that whole movement. Guy and all those great acts that come out of the late 80s. And prior to that, sort of boogie and, you know, I'm like the biggest fan ever of that era. I mean, yeah. I'm probably still stuck very much in 1986. So I was there musically in hip hop, and I was hearing house. I don't quite get it. There's not enough soul in it. Mm-hmm. And I heard this. I was like, wow, okay, right. This is joining the dots between where I am and house music. And then I bought the album, and just every track was killer. I mean, it's not all house on there, but it was something that pointed me in the direction of house music. You know, what Marshall Jefferson had done with that production, and obviously the brilliant vocals of 10 City.
Yeah.
It started to make sense.
Yeah, and like you say, one of those things as well where you could start connecting the dots, like you're talking about earlier, if you're seeing like Marshall Jefferson's name on there or Byron Stingley's name on there, you know, these are names that are going to be like the launch pad for you to be out there researching, you know, these new releases and these new sounds coming over from the US.
Yeah, and I was very much about soulful house music for years and years and years, and I am very much now. In fact, we just launched a new label called Fool's Paradise. Mm-hmm. The first single is it's actually a cover I've done with Beverly Knight of Princess I Want to Be Your Lover.
No way.
And it's where I'm, you know, where my heart is. I mean, I come from soul. That's very much what I'm about. Everything I do, I try to bring that through. Even if it's a tougher, more club focused records, it still has to be underpinned with that feeling of soul. There's always that, you know, that boogie in there. So yeah, when I started making electronic music, like the first record label I ever released on was Zed Records, which is Dave Lee's label, and I played soulful house nights. That's where I'm from, and you know, that album really was the launch pad of everything, really.
Yeah, and you mentioned That's the Way Love Is. Is that the track that is the big one for you off that album?
I guess so. I mean, it's the most obvious choice, but it still stands the test of time. In fact, randomly, there's new mixes from the Soul Avengers, which actually made Killer Cut on my Kiss show this week. So it's still doing the damage now, because it's just melodically and as a song, just great songs stand the test of time, can be reinvented, reinvigorated, brought back to life. And we as a culture need to put more emphasis on that, you know, spend less time on splice, more time writing great hooks, and get working with great musicians to write things that are timeless, because that will inspire the next generation more so than a hook you found on splice. You know, it takes a bit more work, it takes, you know, it's a bit more expensive, but believe you me, it'll have way more impact. And that certainly did for me.
Indeed. Okay, so let's talk about a floor filler, a go-to floor filler. You've chosen your own edit of Peter Brown's Say It Again.
Just
talk to us about that.
It's just one of these records that I tend to play every set, because it never really got on people's radars when it was released. It samples Colonel Abraham and Colonel Abraham's Trapped, just to hook from that. And it's just the perfect record to move from warming up into the next gear. It's the perfect gear shifter record that people know, but they don't know, you know. And they're the gems, you know. That's what DJing's about. It's about finding those records that, in their own right, don't amass to much, but put in the context of a great set, really start to shift the gears and have emphasis. It's about finding all of those gems, not the obvious things that really do the damage. And I don't think I've ever not played that record and it not had a massive reaction.
Awesome. And it works, like you say, in that context of if you are playing that longer set, these records that on their own don't necessarily work sometimes, but they're the ones that change things. I've got to get from here to here. And, you know,
exactly I've that.
Got the length exactly of set that. To be able to make that move.
Yep. And it's one of those records that never fails to deliver. So it's a sort of stalwart in the backbone of my set.
Indeed. Okay. Right. A sunsetter, perfect track to soundtrack a sunset. You've chosen Cloud Kickers, Bring On The Night, the Rocco Trodeep remix.
Yeah. I mean, I think everything's in the title. It's one of those where it's called Bring On The Night. It's one of those, you shut your eyes. I played it at Mamba a few times and it's just all about, right, let's bring on the next phase of what we're doing here. Let's get stuck in. It's dreamy, it's ethereal, but it has such a brilliant kind of feel and notion to it that sort of tingles you and goes, well, okay, something special is about to happen. Let's bring on the night, let's go, you know. So for me, it's the perfect way to kind of transition from day into night. And it's got the right energy as well. It's a really clever arrangement. It starts really quite dreamy and atmospheric and then turns into something it's not club focused, but it's, you know, it's got an energy that feels like it tells a story from what it's trying to say, bring on the night. So it's nigh on perfect for that.
Yeah, no, great choice. I love it. Okay, a tearjerker. This doesn't necessarily have to be house music, but you've chosen a track from 1994, which is a deep dish mix of Elastic Reality, Casa de X.
Yeah.
Tell us about that.
Just brings back some incredible memories of that time. For me, that was kind of real golden era of house music. Some brilliant nights here in the UK. We kind of, things were becoming a little bit more sophisticated. We come out of the fields, we're into nightclubs, and it, you know, it was becoming more structured. Still some incredible, you know, passion and thought going into records, a lot of musicians involved. And I think this is Deep Dish's finest ever hour, their remix of this on the brilliant Tribal Records, Rob Stefano's label from the 90s, which, you know, Danny Tenaglia was a huge part, Deep Dish and all those guys that come out of the US. And it's like 11 minutes long. And that's when you could have a record that was 10, 11 minutes long and people would go for it, you know, that you didn't have to be shortened into a 5-minute formula that people could consume. And it just has this really long atmospheric build. And I remember in 1995, I booked the Masters at Work. We put on a party called the Love Ball around, of course it was for Valentine's Day, in February. And they'd never really played in London outside of the Ministry of Sound. We were the first people to book them. And they started with this, and it's this really long, epic build. I just thought, shit me, man, we put on this party, which we didn't even have the money to put on. How we fumbled our way through it was quite epic. It's a story for another podcast. We got through it all and made about £3, but put on one of the most epic parties London had ever seen. They were playing on four decks, and Louis just started with this. And everyone had consumed quite a lot of narcotics at the time, so there was this sort of euphoric feel on the dance floor. Started this, like you could just feel that the kind of euphoria and passion. And I remember just feeling like, Jesus, what have we done here? We put this incredible event on. So I was being fairly euphoric myself, and then I'm about 3 minutes in, Kenny started looping up the beats from Buckethead's Bomb, so he put that over the top. And they both dropped at the same time. I was like, holy moly. And it just had this moment for me. I mean, that's my personal connection to the record, even though I was a fan of it outside that. But seeing it delivered in that way. But just the chords in the intro are just beautiful. You know what I mean? You can have your own interpretation of what that record means to you, because melodically it really evokes passion. It's just a beautiful piece of electronic music.
Yeah, and it's an epic journey as well. Like you say, 11 minutes, like back in the day, like you were saying about how having those 2.5 minutes extra you need to get things in time on vinyl, this is why those tracks are so long back then.
And I think people have more of an attention span, you know. I think that's consistent with everything in life now. You know, people need to consume things in less than 3 seconds. Well, they didn't necessarily then. You know, I remember, God, around 2000, I couldn't get a record in under 10 minutes. You know, just couldn't get. And it was great because each record really told a story, less so than they do now. You know, you've got to have a breakdown every minute because people just won't accept it. I guess the drugs have worn off a little bit and it's things are a bit different, but that was an incredible moment and incredible record to kind of soundtrack it for me.
And you know, if you're playing a 10-minute track now as well, like what do you do behind the decks for the next like 9.5 minutes while it's playing? Really,
that's the other thing as well. I mean, there was less emphasis on that. I remember when I grew up, you know, and I even to this day, I still worry, why are you looking at me? Like, why am I just putting a record on? You know, I still struggle with that as a notion. Like, why does the DJ have to become the performer? He's just putting records on. It's not like he's playing an instrument as such. It's not that context. You know, when I used to go out back in the day, no one looked at the DJ. You know, I don't give a fuck. You know, you were there, you were listening to the music. You were in it for the music. You didn't need someone's cue to have fun. Mm-hmm. And that's that. And it's got so out of context now. Some DJs look like idiots dancing around, jumping up and down. They're like, it's not about that. That's not the thing. That's not the thing. You know what I mean? Yes, have passion in what you're playing. And you are looked at for a cue of kind of enjoyment. I mean, and I do. When I play, I dance around. And not because I'm looking to show off. It's just because I genuinely love what I'm playing. But it's within context, you know. Yeah. You won't catch me diving off the decks or, you know, putting all these silly stunts. It's just genuine passion. But there was less focus on having to look at what the DJ was doing and more just being lost in the music. And I think we need more of that.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think if you're the DJ and it looks like you're having more fun than the dance floor, then, you know, you're not necessarily doing your job correctly.
No, exactly. It looks a bit weird and we try a bit too hard like that, aren't we?
Indeed. Okay, so we've already kind of covered it, but the last tune, End of the Night, Crowd Are Asking for One More. You've obviously chosen your Mark Knight and Funk Agenda version of The Man with a Red Face. Would there ever be a context where you wouldn't play it?
Yeah, I mean, I don't always play it. Again, if it doesn't feel right and, you know, feel like it won't have the impact, then don't play it. It's about reading the situation. It's not an app, you know, it's not just mechanical that I play it. It's if it makes sense. And, you know, you get to the point now where some audiences don't even know it because they're that bit younger. That has less impact. But again, that's the art of DJing, picking the right record for the right time, you know?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I remember, you know, when we all used to work in offices, a job I used to have, there was a guy sat next to me who's never heard dance music or house music or anything like that before. And he'd been out either some festival or some club and he'd heard it and he knew how much I, you know, was into house music and he played it to me at work. And he's like, I can't get over this tune. It's like, and just to see him, the buzzing of this discovery of this new sound. It was brilliant to watch and see. Cool. Okay, so we always have one final question though, which is we are obviously the House Culture podcast, and we're all about the culture of the scene and you know, your place in it as well as someone who's, you know, not only contributed record label music, you know, your artistry, all of these things. When you think of house music culture and dance music culture, what do you make of it and what do you think of the good and the bad things about it?
So, I mean, I fell in love with the original idea of culture, of the culture of house music, you know, that kind of, as we touched on earlier, that unity, that collectiveness. I mean, it had such a massive impact. It ended football violence overnight.
Mm-hmm.
You know, let's not forget that. You know, it literally, football violence at the end of the 80s was massive. It was horrible. It was not a nice place. Dance music just killed it. And I remember being in this story one Friday night and ended up in this flat in Edmonton in North London with, like, you know, what would have been, you know, football hooligans. It was pretty, you know, they're pretty tough chaps. Normally you wouldn't be there, and we're all sat in the kitchen, you know, in the Moesie Dill and the lounge in the morning, all sort of coming down from the night before, being best mates, we'll definitely meet up next week. I was like, wow, this is brilliant. I wouldn't normally be here. And now I've got a bunch of new mates, and they were. We would all end up going to the same raves, and then it was the same thing in the Ministry of Sound. It was an incredible night there called Ruling on Saturday nights. Mm-hmm. And it was, I would say it was as influential in the UK as the Paradise Garage was in America. It was that legendary. It was a really special moment. And to be part of that, and to be part of the family of clubbers that went every week, because there were no mobile phones, there was no way of connecting with each other. You met on the dance floor on Saturday night. Mm-hmm. And that's how friendships were born for people all over the country. And that was a very special thing, you know. I think we see less of that now due to the internet, and the community aspect of it is diminished, I think. I mean, I don't know, I guess, because I'm the other side of the fence now. I'm working within that context and less as a punter. So I don't want to make too sweeping statements, but I feel there's not enough of that original ethos still in the scene now. Too many big brands making big statements that say that they are that and they're not. Mm-hmm. You know, I think we need to strip back, to get back to more of that inclusivity, that community aspect of what this brought us. So I'm all about that. You know, it's the same thing in hip hop when hip hop started. I'm so lucky to live through two huge cultural movements, birth of hip hop and then the birth of electronic music. And it's all about, hip hop was all about crew mentality, about, you know, whether you were breakdancing together, or you were doing graph or whatever, you were a crew. Mm-hmm. And then house music was the same thing. And let's not lose that. Let's not lose that collectiveness and the fun you had together, enjoying brilliant music in brilliant situations. You know, I do hope that we maintain that as an ideal and an ethos of what this is all about. So that's what I love about it, and that's what I fell in love with, and you know, and I want to use what we're doing, the platform that we have now, to remind people about that it's not about I. House music is not about I, it's about we. You know, there's no I in house. Mm-hmm. You know, there really isn't, and that's what it should be all about. So yeah, let's spend less time focusing on us and what I'm doing. It's like, what are we doing collectively as a thing? And don't be frightened to celebrate each other's successes and helping each other out. That's what it should be about. And we can just remind ourselves that that's what we, you know, that's what the original values of house music are about. That's why it started. It started in fairly sort of difficult times, should I say, you know, and it was an escape from that. It was the antithesis of what that situation was about, and let's make sure that we never lose sight of that.
I love it. Brilliant thought to end on. That's amazing. Thank you so much.
Oh, thanks, Matt. Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it. Really, really enjoyed it. All right, Matt. Bye, son, mate. Take care.
House culture.
What a lovely fella, right? I really enjoyed that one. Not only was it inspiring to hear about his vision for the scene, as well as what he's done for it, it was really interesting to hear about his approach to it as a business as well. Lots to be learned for us all, I reckon. As you heard, in this 20th anniversary year for Tool Room, Mark's already had a very busy August, and the Music Matters Tour continues with events in Chicago, Montreal, Bucharest and Bali before the end of the year. Let us know if you're lucky enough to catch him at any of those. And Mark's new Fool's Paradise label has had an incredible launch with his cover version of Prince's I Wanna Be Your Lover, featuring the gorgeous vocals of Beverly Knight. This achieved a track source number one. The latest release also doing the damage on his label is Mark's remake of the Mojo classic Lady, so be sure to check that out as well. Speaking of tracks, get yourself over to the House Culture Perfect playlist on Spotify. This is where Mark's submissions now feature alongside all of the other choices from our previous podcast guests. However, if you want to hear that epic 9.5-minute deep dish mix of Elastic Reality's Casa de X, you'll have to check that one out on YouTube. Whilst you're over at Spotify, you can now drop us a comment in the Q&A section under the episode description. Or if you're not listening via those green guys, feel free to leave us a review on Apple, a comment on YouTube, or even a message on our Instagram. Hearing your feedback plays a massive part in keeping this show going. Could even get you a shout out on a future episode. This time around, I want to say a huge hi, as well as a massive thank you to Gravesy, who took it upon himself to donate some of his hard-earned cash to us via the supporter feature linked in the show notes. He said that he's loving the series. The walk down memory lane has been an absolute joy and that he will be contributing again. Thank you so much, Gravesy. If you're listening to this, drop us a note directly so we can thank you more personally. If you want to stay in touch with us, you can do that by following us on Instagram at HouseCultureNet, by following the hashtag TrueHouseCulture. And if you want to follow me directly, you can find me on Instagram at DJMattRouse. Thanks for listening. Rave safe and see you next time.
House Culture.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.